According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue. That's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian defense minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist. He explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticized for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonized. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corey from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corey became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corey, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corey's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things that Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corey acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Purizab, London.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military operation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the news on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
UNAID drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now. Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz, promise of life. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 21st of March, corresponding with the 1st of Farvardin, which marks the start of spring and the new Iranian year. In this episode, you will hear some of the signs of Nowruz, which inspire happiness. The earth has got tired of winter and wishes freshness and liveliness. As the spring nears in the northern hemisphere, all plants gradually wake up and put on new clothes. The earth becomes green and flowers fill the air with their sweet fragrances. The inspiring smell of spring is felt everywhere as people are in the hustle to make everything clean and new. A few weeks before Nowruz, people start house cleaning to accompany the nature. They try to buy new clothes for the family members. Streets are busy and there is big boom in businesses. As houses are clean and beautiful, they should have symbols of freshness too. Therefore, most people let wheat or lentil and peas in little plates to have fresh sprouts during Nowruz days. These fresh sprouts will decorate the haftzin tablecloth. Haftzin tablecloth is composed of seven items which begin with letter S, seen in Farsi. One of these items is called sabze, or fresh sprouts. It symbolizes freshness and greenery. The morning of the 1st of Farvardin is a very beautiful and joyous time. Everyone is happy at the turn of the year. We heard a nice song which was a description of spring and Nowruz. Late Fereydun Pur Reza used to sing simple and intimate songs. As it was said in the previous episode, at the turn of the year, people usually recite this prayer. O transformer of hearts and sights, O administrator of night and day, O changer of the condition and states, change our state to the best state. This prayer is recited in order to appeal to God for granting us the best conditions and blessings. This reminds us that even in happy moments, we should remember God and thank Him for His blessings and ask Him for the best. As the year turns, hearts are filled with hope and motive. This hope motivates us to move for achieving our goals and making of a better future. Nowruz is like a beautiful garment, which the Iranian nation and the nations adhering to Nowruz culture have grown up with. This ancient feast is among the strong elements of the Iranian culture. This feast is celebrated by all ethnicities in Iranians. However, Nowruz is different for young children. It is accompanied by taking gifts from the elderly and wearing new clothes. Nowruz is celebrated by a number of other nations, including Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan. It is also marked by minorities in Pakistan, India, and some of the Central Asian countries.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Saudi oil facility Aramco has been targeted by the Yemeni army. It was a major operation that did not include just the Aramco oil facility. It came in response to the continued Saudi aggression against the country. The war in Yemen, now in its seventh year, shows no signs of reaching a political resolve. But why? Why does Saudi Arabia continue a war that it is not winning on the ground? And why does the U.S. continue to support this war militarily? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me first introduce our guest. For this edition of The Spotlight, we have Hossein Al-Bokhaiti joining us. He's an activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Hamza Karim. He's a political commentator who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Hossein Al-Bokhaiti, let me first start with you, if I may. We're looking at a major attack that's taken place. It's not reported as such, but it really is a major attack. Drones that have hit the Saudi energy and water desalination facilities, looking at petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region. I can go on with this list. It's quite an extensive list. Tell us the significance of this major attack.
and what type of reaction mentally could Saudi Arabia be thinking of when it receives such a blow to its facilities?
I think what the Saudi Arabia have now to do is to accept that they cannot continue with this war, and to accept that Yemeni army is well equipped to target all Saudi oil infrastructure and power plant, and as well as they did today, water treatment plant. Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has enforced a blockade on Yemen, killing hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians. And since Biden sworn as U.S. president, he realized that military action on Yemen against Sana'a forces has failed. That's why they have, for the last year, tightened their blockade, blocking fuel from entering Yemen. And this actually affects all water supplies and electricity supplies in Yemen. Many hospitals are running low in fuel, and there are a warning that they might be closing. And Yemeni army, when he has launched his first attack, they call it breaking the siege operation. And today we have seen three operations against Saudi Arabia, which target mainly and focused mainly on Saudi refinery and oil infrastructure, including power station. I think that Yemeni army now want to send a clear message to Saudi Arabia that the fire that they that you have created in Yemen, the suffering of Yemeni civilians, will be sent back to Saudi Arabia. But as well, we see on the top of all that, that all this attack, that maybe it could be more than 40 ballistic missile and drone and drones, and as well cruise missile has targeted Saudi Arabia. Not a single civilians was killed, and to show you the accuracy of these weapons used today. And as well, I want to mention that in all those three operations, they have used cruise missile, and we've seen in many footage released by some Saudi media showing some fire in some of those areas that was targeted. This shows that Yemeni army now has taken the decision to break the siege by attacking Saudi and by attacking their oil infrastructure, and they must stop, or they're going to see in the coming hours or days more attack against Saudi Arabia.
Okay, some good points made there, Hamza Karim, by our guest in Sana'a. In particular, what we're looking at, again, is the depth of the number of targets that the Yemeni army has hit. And our guest there talked about the precision. And that points to the fact that you're looking at the Yemeni army to have had major advancements in its arsenal throughout the years, this being one of them, which, again, it's surprising how it's not being reported. So if you take this attack and you cite all the different points, if you're Saudi Arabia, and then you take a look at, for example, the different accomplishments of Saudi Arabia, or should I say its mercenaries on the ground, you don't see a comparison that can be even made there, because the accomplishments by the Yemeni army far outweighs what Saudi Arabia has accomplished on the ground. Doesn't that point to Saudi defeat, which requires a complete revamp of the way they're approaching this war militarily?
Absolutely, definitely. You know, if we look at the war for the past 7 years, Saudi Arabia have used all their cards in this war, starting from using really, you know, engaging in really heavy military operations in Yemen in different front lines. After that, they started tightening the, you know, the economy of Yemen by closing the airports and the ports. They've used all the cards in Yemen to try to, you know, accomplish any of the objectives that they announced when they started this war in 2015. But after 7 years, we see that none of these objectives were achieved. And I believe, you know, right now what they're trying to do is basically try to tighten more the siege that is imposed on Yemen to really put pressure on people. And human beings there in Yemen. So this shows that really they could not accomplish anything. And, you know, if I were in Saudi Arabia or to advise them something, is that, you know, they need to change the way that they're dealing with this war. I think after 7 years and not being able to achieve any militarily or political, you know, achievements there, they need to start thinking about this war in a different way. They need to start engaging in serious peace talks with Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a. There need to be some serious actions on ground to show that really they're changing of the way that they're thinking about this war. But we see that they still continue doing what they've been doing for the past 7 years, and they don't seem to be you know, learning from their mistakes and the way they're dealing with this war.
Okay, Hussein Abdelkaiti, on the political front, there has been some movements made there by the UN. And I believe that you are of the opinion that the talks, which I believe were set to take place in Saudi Arabia, you believe that that is the wrong move, that the Yemen should not participate in the country that's doing the bombing. Also, there's a point about the siege, where the last time around where there were political talks, the siege was a point of contention where the Yemeni government said, listen, lift the siege. And yet Saudi Arabia did not do that. Why is Saudi Arabia not lifting the siege before we talk about the political movements taking place?
I mean, it's clearly that they are using the humanitarian crisis and disaster on Yemen as a weapons. I mean, all the ships that are that should be actually arriving to Hodeidah, either fuel or food, they have been searched by the United Nations and as well by the Saudi coalition. And there is a United Nations team after a Hodeidah agreement in December 2018 in Stockholm. That team is now have been working in Hodeidah for over 2 years. But still, Saudi, because they have failed military, they think that using this humanitarian pressure, especially on fuel, which everything in Yemen and in any other country depend on fuel, they think as well in their media, they try to blame this shortages of fuel to blame Sana'a government, because they think that they can deceive the Yemeni population. But on the other hand, we see that there are more people are joining the front line to fight Saudi Arabia. And as well, your first part of your question about the Saudi suggested to have talks in Riyadh, I don't think, and as well, Sana'a should not accept this, because they have refused, especially Ansarullah, to go to Saudi Arabia before the start of this war, because Saudi has been playing a dirty part in Yemen by supporting terrorism, by supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and supporting other groups who have been targeting Yemeni civilians, either by suicide or by killing or kidnapping. That's why, I mean, it will be really, really impossible that the same country that has launched the war and you denied and refused to go in the first week of that war to talk in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia still consider what's happening in Yemen as a civil war. They think that they try to believe that they are not part of this war. And I think if Yemeni will accept that, this means that Saudi Arabia has won the war, because Saudi Arabia will not be obligated to pay any compensation for the killing of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni right. civilians, or for the destruction that's happening in Yemen. And I think one last thing, that when Saudi announced that they are ready to hold talks in Riyadh, I think because they know that the anniversary of the war, which is going to be on 26th of March, after maybe 10 days, they know that Yemeni army will launch a huge attack against Saudi Arabia. That's why they want to be to look like that they are the one who want peace. But I believe they don't want peace. They just want to make Yemeni civilians suffer. And now the responsibility is on Sana'a government to stop all that.
Well, we need to talk about this, because this is how this picture is being painted, Hamza Karim, in terms of how the media is wording the way that this war is taking place. And one of the things that is glaringly false is the following, where many media outlets say the violent struggle between Yemen's internationally recognized government, and I'm quoting, supported by a Saudi-led military coalition, and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Now, there are a couple of things here that are just false. When they talk about Yemen's internationally recognized governments, who is internationally recognizing this government is the first question. Because when you look at what happened with elections, there was only one candidate. And that is not criteria for a democratic election. And plus, when you talk about Abd Rabbuh Mansur Hadi, most Yemenis don't recognize him as obviously their leader. Secondly, when they talk about this Iran-backed Houthi rebels, I mean, it's Iran does obviously support the Yemeni people. Why shouldn't it? They're being bombed. There's a harsh, severe humanitarian crisis. They're supporting that. But it kind of gives the idea that militarily Iran is supporting the Yemeni army and obviously the Nasrallah fighters. Why is this false narrative being do you think, described in the way that it is?
Yeah, definitely. You know, Saudi Arabia and the international media outlets, they've been, since the war started in Yemen, they've been trying to position this war as a civil war between Yemeni parties. Now, there's definitely some internal problems between the Yemeni parties in Yemen, but this doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia is not playing the biggest role in this war. Without Saudi Arabia, this war would never have happened. When we're talking about the internationally recognized government, it's basically the government that really U.S. and Saudi Arabia wants to for them to be running Yemen. So Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi was elected in 2014 in a one-candidate election for 2 years, and then after 1 year, they extended their his presidency for another year. So basically, February 2015, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi wasn't the president of Yemen, and the war was launched in March 2015. So even if we're talking about it from a legal perspective, he's not anymore the president. Now, when talking about Iran, now if you see Saudi Arabia, they've been supported by all the countries in the Western world. They've been buying arms from US, UK, France, Belgium, Germany, and a lot of other countries. How can you now, you know, try to convince Houthis that they cannot have partners and allies? But for them, they're Saudi Arabia has the right to deal with all the governments in the world when they want to impose on Ansar Allah and the government in Sana'a that they can't have partners and allies. This doesn't make any sense. Saudi Arabia can have their own allies. Yemen as well are allowed, and they have the right to decide who their allies should be.
Okay, Hossein Abukhaiti, the UN is trying very hard to make sure that talks take place. My question to you is, what type of talks can lead to any type of results or for the talks to be successful unless there is a party that the Saudi coalition or Saudi Arabia has in mind, somebody other than Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi that can be part of these talks? In other words, somebody that Yemenis also accepts in order to, for there to be a compromise of any kind, if there is going to be one. So if they want to present Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, how can the talks even lead to any type of success?
I mean, this is actually the problem, because when they call Hadi as the legitimate president or the legitimate government, Hadi he won an election. He was the only candidate. And I mean, if the United Nations actually want to help Yemeni and to reach a peace deal or to reach a talk, they should at the beginning, accept that the Saudi is committing a war crime against Yemen by blocking food and fuel, by closing airport and port across Yemen, by preventing ships and fuel shipment to enter Yemen. I mean, this is a war crime. It doesn't matter who's in this war. And as well, they keep calling the war in Yemen, they call it as a Yemeni crisis or a civil war. So if the United Nations will not accept that Saudi Arabia is a major part in this war, and as well Sana'a forces, and as well other parties, and at that point, then Yemenis, I'm sure that they will accept any talk, but it should be in a country that is not involved in this war. They have suggested many months that Muscat or Oman could be that place, but why Saudi Arabia did not accept that? Because they want to make a win from any political talks to be held in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia actually want to make Yemeni feel that they are the one who opened Riyadh for them to reach a peace deal, and that they are the one who have struck this deal. But to be honest with you, the United Nations has been biased from the beginning of the war. And sure, as an example, the attack that has been taking place, as an example, on Sana'a many years ago, killing 1,000 Yemeni civilians on the Great Hall, funeral hall, United Nations has called it as an incident, and they have never ever condemned Saudi Arabia. Okay. United Nations now as well is a biased, and they could not be part of any future deal.
All right. We have not talked about the U.S. here, which I'm going to ask you, Hamza Karim. What are we looking at when it comes to the U.S.? The media somewhat paints the picture now that they're somewhat confused as to what they're going to do. But when you take a look at the facts, arms sales continue. So what is the U.S. position in a minute, less than a minute, if you can say it?
Sure. You know, Saudi Arabia, this is their war in Yemen. This is the war of the U.S. in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is being used as a tool by U.S. We all remember in 2015 when the war started. It started from it was announced from the White House in Washington. Without the arms sales that and the logistic support and the intelligence support that Saudi Arabia has been given by U.S., this war wouldn't continue. Okay. And Saudi Arabia wouldn't be able to defend itself. So definitely, U.S. is playing the major role here in this war.
Thank you for that, Hamza Korean political commentator from Toronto. Hossein Abukhaiti, many thanks, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Congratulations to everyone who celebrates Nowruz. We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
Every day, more than 1,000 Americans are still dying of COVID, says Stephen Harper Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The Expendable Americans in a Pandemic." Stay tuned for more. On March 14, 2022, 7 million Americans and their families became victims again. For the first time since the COVID pandemic began, Republicans jettisoned Congress's bipartisan approach of providing no-strings emergency funds to the battle of the virus. Instead, the GOP insisted that Democrats find a way to pay for ongoing COVID testing, treatment, and vaccines. Otherwise, Republicans would scuttle the $1.5 trillion omnibus bill funding the entire federal government through September. The bill also included a $42 billion increase in military spending and almost $14 billion in emergency aid for the military. According to a study published in JAMA Network on December 28, 2021, the vulnerable American population is at increased risk of breakthrough COVID-19 infection that can have severe and even fatal outcomes. The COVID funds were a rounding error, a $15.6 billion item, or 1% of the omnibus bill. To assuage Republicans, Democrats pulled $7 billion from state aid allocated in a previous relief package. But pushback from governors and some House Democrats caused Speaker Nancy Pelosi to remove COVID funding from the bill altogether. The number two Republican in the Senate, John Thune, tried to blame Democrats. He said, "We had a chance to get that last week and the House progressive wing blew it up. They torpedoed it." Given the GOP's new demand that Democrats find a way to pay for this round of COVID plan, that's nonsense. For immunocompromised citizens, like many Americans, vaccination offers some protection, but the science is clear. According to a study published in JAMA Network on December 28, 2021, the vulnerable American population is at increased risk of breakthrough COVID-19 infection that can have severe and even fatal outcomes. Individuals 65 and over account for 75% of all deaths. Likewise, across all age ranges, more than 7 million American adults live with compromised immune systems that impede vaccine effectiveness. In a recent study, vaccinated immunosuppressed patients accounted for 44% of breakthrough hospitalizations, and an even greater percentage, about 98%, were over 50, which makes Americans a double dipper in the COVID pool. In his State of the Union message, President Biden said, "We're leaving no one behind or ignoring anyone's needs as we move forward." He then outlined his plan for stockpiles of tests, masks, pills, if Congress provides the funds they needed. Well, Congress dropped that ball, but the Biden administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention share some of the blame for the current plight in the United States of America. As of last summer, COVID had killed 580,000 Americans, but Biden said the worst was over. The CDC announced that anyone vaccinated didn't need to wear a mask indoors or outdoors. When Delta arrived, infections and hospitalizations soared, but most people remained in an "I've moved on, I'm so done with COVID" state of denial. As Omicron engulfed the world and swamped hospitals yet again, that mindset persisted. America paid the price for its denialism. By January 2022, the country was approaching 1 million COVID deaths, and the CDC told everyone to wear N95 masks for the best protection against Omicron. A month later, the CDC revised its metrics to focus on hospital admissions rather than infections. Using the new criteria, most of the country went from high community transmission levels to medium or low levels overnight, and suddenly 70% of Americans could remove their masks. But every day, more than 1,000 Americans are still dying of COVID. Now, rising infection and hospitalization rates in Europe provide troubling signs that another wave may be on the way. As Dr. Eric Topel recently wrote, that in itself requires preparedness. Unfortunately, we have a mindset that the pandemic is over, which couldn't be further than the truth. Now, we have a new perspective on how handicapped individuals must have felt before the Americans with Disabilities Act became law. The COVID fate remains in the hands of people motivated to look the other way. Americans have become an unwanted footnote in discussions about transitioning the country from pandemic, which is where they still are, to so-called endemic, a goal for which they have no real pain or plan. Lip service about leaving no one behind has yielded to social Darwinism, making 7 million people like anyone in the United States expendable. The country shouldn't come to a screeching halt because some of Americans have compromised immune systems that make COVID especially dangerous. But presenting that as the only alternative to moving on, the message that people embrace because they want to hear is disingenuous. Rather than promoting magical thinking, the U.S. officials should tell Americans the truth. Just because you haven't contracted severe COVID doesn't mean that the pandemic is over. Just because you don't have symptoms doesn't mean that you can't transmit the virus to someone who will develop serious complications with tragic consequences. Rather than sowing doubt about scientific facts, provide funds for testing, treatment, and vaccines, all of which are now in imminent jeopardy. Adopting those public health measures should be characterized as bipartisan victories. They will not only better protect the most vulnerable now, but also help everyone defeat future lethal variants. Helping Americans, the immunocompromised helps everyone in the world.
In the limelight.
A study finds that average Briton produces more carbon in 2 days than a Congolese person does in an entire year. We now present you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled, West Accused of Climate Hypocrisy as Emissions Dwarf Those of Poor Countries. According to an analysis by the Center for Global Development, in the first 2 days of January, the average Briton was already responsible for more carbon dioxide emissions than someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo would produce in an entire year. The study, which highlights the vast energy inequality between rich and poor countries, found that each Briton produces 200 times the climate emissions of the average Congolese person, with people in the United States producing 585 times as much. It found by the end of January, the carbon emitted by someone living in the United Kingdom will surpass the annual emissions of citizens of 30 low- and middle-income countries. Ewan Ritchie, a policy analyst at the Center for Global Development, Europe, said his work was prompted by the climate hypocrisy of Western countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, that have pledged to stop aid funding to fossil fuel projects in developing states. Ewan Ritchie said, at COP26, there was lots of hand-wringing by rich countries about the extent to which aid and other development finance should finance fossil fuels in poorer countries. The hypocrisy of this caught my attention. Ewan Ritchie noted, our analysis shows that in just a few days, the average person in the United Kingdom produces more climate emissions than people in many low-income countries do in an entire year. It would be a cruel irony if the countries that have least contributed to this problem won't be able to have access to energy infrastructure. Several countries, including some developing countries and finance institutions, have signed up to a pledge to end public support for international fossil fuel projects. The same countries will be able to continue to develop fossil fuels at home. The United States has at least 24 pending fossil fuel projects, representing more than 1.6 gigatons of potential greenhouse gas emissions, while the United Kingdom is licensing new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. The Center for Global Development research used World Bank data of per capita carbon emissions for each country spread out over a year to calculate the point at which a British or an American citizen's energy energy use surpassed that of someone living in low or middle-income country. About 940 million people, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, do not have access to electricity. African leaders, including President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria, who has committed Nigeria to net zero emissions by 2060, and Lazarus Chakwera, the president of Malawi, have spoken out about their country's need to transition to net zero emissions via natural gas. The Energy for Growth Hub, an international research network, estimates that if 48 countries in Africa, excluding South Africa and several North African nations, tripled their electricity consumption through use of natural gas, the resulting carbon emissions would be less than 1% of the global total. Vijaya Ramachandran, the Director of Energy and Development at the Breakthrough Institute in Berkeley, California, argues that blanket bans on fossil fuel projects in poor countries are colonial and will entrench poverty while doing little to reduce the world's carbon dioxide emissions. She said, "It's very easy for rich countries to impose fossil fuel financing bans on poor countries while at the same time increasing their own consumption of fossil fuels." She added, "It's rank hypocrisy and it's devastating for poor countries as they need a wide range of energy to fuel development." She noted, "It's well known renewable energy is intermittent and needs to be backed up by other sources of energy. Telling African countries they just need solar power is completely hypocritical and colonial." Rose Mutiso, the Research Director of Energy for Growth Hub, said the Center for Global Development Research should be used to inform the debate over responsibility for the climate crisis. Rose Mutiso, who is a Kenyan, said, "Solving the climate crisis in the medium term is the responsibility of high-emitting countries, not only because they caused the problem in the first place, but logically, it's where high emissions are concentrated." She said, "The video gaming industry in California is using more energy than entire African countries. There's this idea that in California we can't live without video games or air conditioning, but we are worried about Africans moving up and consuming. It's really important for us as Africans to establish that our development is non-negotiable. All of those decades of exploitation and being left behind that is owed to us." Rose Mutiso cited a 2019 study that estimated electricity demand from the gaming industry in California alone would grow from 5 terawatt hours in 2011 to as much as 11 terawatt hours by 2021, the same as Sri Lanka's entire electricity consumption. Meanwhile, electricity could be delivered to more than a billion people currently living without it within a decade, by linking up small-scale projects into a giant, environmentally friendly network. According to a new global commission, advances in micro-energy grids and renewable energy technologies could dramatically accelerate change and transform lives in rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and also in South Asia. The Global Commission to End Energy Poverty met for the first time recently to set out plans to accelerate the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal to ensure access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for all the peoples of the world by 2030. The commission, established by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative and the Rockefeller Foundation, plans to bring together leading investors, utilities, and policymakers to tackle energy poverty. Under the initiative, the distributed networks would help connect homes, businesses, and schools to small-scale solar power projects to deliver cheap, sustainable electricity that can help power local economic growth. The commission includes government leaders, energy industry chief executives, and representatives from major development organizations. Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and formerly of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said, "A whole new way of thinking about energy distribution was required." Dr. Rajiv Shah said, "We cannot end poverty without successfully ending energy poverty. For 140 years, we've had this mindset that energy access means building big power plants and connecting them to national grids, and that's how you provide electricity." Dr. Rajiv Shah noted, "Today, new technology frontiers, business models, and our knowledge of alternatives is so strong that this commission will be able to set out a new roadmap to end the energy access problem for 1 billion people across the globe." The Commission also plans to help set up new regulation in developing countries to accelerate the rollout of new energy systems and make the projects more attractive to international investors. Dr. Rajiv Shah explained, "If I want to start a small solar-powered mini-grid program in a rural part of an underserved country, I could be prevented from actually providing power without permission from the state-owned utility, which might own that business opportunity. That's one of the many policy roadblocks that is preventing distributed solutions from really being easy to invest in." Dr. Rajiv Shah will co-chair the commission alongside Dr. Ernest Moniz, a former U.S. Energy Secretary, and Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank. Dr. Ernest Moniz warned that existing plans to end global energy poverty by 2030 are not fast enough and should be more ambitious. He said, 20 years ago, energy access might have been defined by having a 20-watt light bulb. One doesn't want to denigrate that. The shift from having no light to some light is major, but our ambition is more than that. We want energy access that allows for credible family, community, and regional economic development. Frankly, we'd like it to allow for entrepreneurial activity as well. Dr. Moniz said that by relying on renewable energy, particularly solar power, alongside batteries, developing nations should be able to attract investment in clean energy and rule out the need for future investments in coal-fired power plants. He said adapting such methods could also halt the wood burning that has led to mass deforestation in some countries.